Hello, I'm Brad Addington, Chief Editor of Packaging Strategies, and this is the Packaging Perspectives Podcast. Today we're discussing challenges facing the paper industry and what those challenges mean for packaging companies when it comes to choosing materials for packaging and labeling. My guest is Carl Kanner, Vice President at Smith Corona. Hey, Carl, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. Now, you and I spoke back in December 2022 about challenges facing the paper industry. And now that we're several months into 2023, I thought it would be good to revisit this issue and see where things stand now. So I have some questions for you. Now, a Smith Corona article posted earlier this year said that the paper industry isn't attractive enough for investors. And because investors are lacking, we're seeing a lot of debt loom for paper mills. And as a result, more and more private equity companies are buying them. How has the involvement of private equity become a rising issue for the paper industry?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great question. And thank you for having me participate on the podcast here today. And sure. I would say that, you know, you're entirely right. You know, there has been an over leveraging of the paper mills in our industry, and therefore, at least certainly of the publicly traded paper mills, they've been able to be acquired for very low dollar amounts because the equities become, you know, very much so reduced as a result of a lot of the debt leverage and unprofitability of these mills. Mm-hmm. I would say, in regards to the private equity firms, I wouldn't necessarily say it's like an issue in a bad way, but it's definitely a change. The private equity companies, of course, act in the best interest of their investor partners, and they have to allocate capital one above their own internal hurdle rates, but also the highest and best use amongst all of their other portfolio companies that they may have. And I think when approached from this framework of maximizing returns for their investors and, you know, efficiently allocating capital, a lot of these decisions that we've seen in our paper industry are quite frankly, you know, fairly rational. And once, you know, looking at domestically owned, publicly traded mills and their track record, it really hasn't fared, you know, really all that much better than what we've seen from the private equity held ones. U.S. mills have lacked investment, and they face continued input cost pressures, which have further reduced rates of returns for all equity holders. There really are very few, what I'd say, like truly privately held paper mills. You know, owned by an individual or a family or something like this, as opposed to some sort of like LP structure, like a private equity or publicly traded. And the ones that have existed, I think they tend to have done better. And in my experience visiting those mills, you can see there tends to be more investment in capital equipment. The mills tend to be, I want to say, cleaner, but maybe like a little more organized or a little more care brought to that. And, you know, this is a generalization. I mean, this is not true of all these mills, but certainly here in North America, when I visit like a mill, for example, like Kruger Paper, which is a privately held consortium of paper mills, you know, they have very new equipment. They're very clean. They're very well run. And I think that perspective is a bit different when you see that. The concern, I think, with private equity comes more into play when you take paper mills that are operating with a high degree of leverage that is inherent in this business, and you couple that with private equity investors who typically like to add financial leverage, be that through acquisition, in a leverage buyout strategy, or through some sort of recapitalization where they, you know, buy the company, add a bunch of debt, and dividend out the excess capital to themselves and then to their partners. Yeah. But I think when you couple those two together, high degree of operating leverage and financial leverage, you, of course, you know, reduce margin of safety within the business, and you create a precarious situation that, you know, when once you face some negative headwinds, it can be really challenging to overcome. And that, unfortunately, has been, you know, the experience, at least from my time in the business with these private equity firms, they tend to have bought these companies, leveraged them up further. And then when the, you know, going's gotten tough or something, they, you know, it's led to either mill closures or you know, sales or something like this. But I don't think it's necessarily always been that way with private equity firms. There are some examples of some really good actors in this space who I think, you know, are worth calling out for having done a great job. One of those is Atlas, who acquired both Finch Paper and Twin Rivers. Twin Rivers is a supplier in the space that we play in, which is pressure sensitive labels. And from time to time, we purchase paper from them. And they operate a paper mill in an area called Madawaska, Maine, which is, it's actually the most northern part of the continental United States. I've had the misfortune of having to go there in this time of year, and it's not it's not as nice as one would imagine. But it's an interesting mill because they have it straddles the border with the United States and Canada, and they literally the pulp mill is in Canada, and they make this, you know, the slurry of pulp, and they bring it underneath the river in a pipeline to the to the paper mill, which is in Madawaska, which is a really neat operation. But they've done a really fabulous job of running that mill, meaning Atlas, who are the current owners. And they, you know, I think they're an interesting case because they have looked at this paper mill and, you know, in this remote place, they were able to acquire it for, I think, not a lot of money, and they've invested in it. But they've also invested in the whole vertical, which gives them a different perspective. They acquired another company called Iconics, which is, of course, the largest manufacturer of receipt paper, I think globally, but certainly in the Western Hemisphere here. Mm-hmm. And Iconics, as a portfolio company under Atlas, I think gives them this kind of interesting perspective. Iconics also bought the label division of what was Syndeo. So they have this, they have both on one end, the raw material, but on the other end, they're producing finished product going to the end customer, which has kind of created this natural hedge for them, which I think offsets some of the leverage, you know, that's inherent in this business. And because of that, they've been a more rational player, I think, and a good steward for both the mills and for the industry. Stepping outside of
involved along the whole chain, like you said, like from raw material to finished product. So that's good.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that's very similar to us here at Smith Corona. We don't go as far back as the paper mill, but I mean, we're vertically integrated in the sense, you know, we make our own adhesives and we do all our own coatings, like similar to like what Avery Dennison does. And then we sell finished product. And I think because of, you know, as the industry's gotten more and more compressed in terms of, you know, let's call it profit margins, you know, you have to integrate backwards and you have to do something your competitor doesn't. And I think it's applauding Atlas here, because I think this strategy has been a really good one. And it's kind of similar to what UPM has done. UPM is one of the largest fine paper companies manufacturers in the world, but they're also, they have a subsidiary called Raffletech, which competes with Avery Dennison, making these pressure sensitive adhesive laminates. Mm-hmm. Just in the same way that Atlas has this natural hedge with Iconics, UPM has this hedge here with UPM Raffletech, which gives them a different perspective on the mill, or sorry, a different perspective on making paper, which I think really gives them the wherewithal to stay in these ups and downs that we see.
You're going to have ups and downs in the industry. So,
yeah. And I think kind of one more part to that question is just sort of, you know, when you look at the different ownership structures here in the US, and, you know, here I talked about private equity and privately held companies, and then the publicly owned companies, you also have to look a little bit at the difference between North American publicly owned companies and European owned publicly companies, because there is a big difference, I think, in how European owned publicly traded paper companies have operated, where there has been more of a how do I say this, like a holistic approach to it, where they're not solely concerned on creating profits and returning those to the equity holders. There is a little bit of a look at, hey, who are the other stakeholders involved in this business?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of cases, you know, there's certainly the town where the mill is located, you know, which there's a lot of secondary employment that comes out of those mills. There's the industry, you know, who consumes those products. And I think because of that, the European operators have tended to be more willing to invest in the paper mills, even though perhaps the expected rate of return on those investments is lower than perhaps in, you know, some other industry or you know, some other application.
They're still willing to invest.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that that's something that, you know, Americans, you know, here, you know, we should adopt that strategy, because I mean, I think a lot of the European owned companies are also partially owned by, you know, pension funds and things. So they're, you know, their capital structures are different than ours here. But, you know, as a customer of these products, there's something to be said about that ownership structure that, you know, gives us a little bit more, you know, comfort. I can buy from UPM and I know that they're a disciplined owner operator, they're investing in their mills, they're taking care of their assets, and they're not just, you know, trying to harvest cash out of these things and they're not going to be here in 5 years. You know, not that I like to pay more, but, you know, you do end up paying more for security, and you end up paying more for a sustainable partner.
That makes sense. What about, unfortunately, as we know, some mills do close. I guess a recent example is the Androscoggin mill in Maine. Any thoughts on how lack of investment in that particular mill led to its closure?
Yeah, so I think, you know, let's start with that Andro mill and you know, kind of going back on what happened there. So when their pulp digester exploded in April of 2020, Lindsay Goldberg, the private equity owners, were given an option to either rebuild the digester or take a payout of $350 million. They opted to take the money. You know, was that the wrong decision? You know, I don't know. Putting myself back in April of 2020, we were right in the midst of the COVID lockdown and a point of maximum uncertainty of the future, and certainly, you know, the future of, you know, specialty papers. The mill was well positioned in the release liner market, but at this time, the market was oversupplied and pricing pressure would have limited profitability. At the time, I think Lindsay Goldberg made a completely rational decision not to rebuild, pocket the money, and, you know, quite frankly, produce a big windfall for their investors.
Yeah.
In April of 2022, Lindsay Goldberg sold Pixel to HIG for an undisclosed amount. In September of 22, HIG announced its intention to close the mill or sell it. No one came forth to buy it. I think there were a number of reasons, some environmental and some for market reasons. But, you know, it ended up just closing here the beginning of this month. So that mill was completely closed, no longer producing paper.
Yeah.
So ask the question, you know, was HIG wrong to sell the mill? Well, unfortunately, you know, I think there were, you know, a lot of compounding factors that drove HIG to make that decision. The pulp digester exploded right at the beginning of a mega cycle in pulp pricing. And this left, you know, Pixel forced, you know, to really enter into really unfavorable contracts for pulp, you know, as pulp prices rose, and they didn't really have an ability to buy spot rate pulp because, you know, this headwind pressure of rising pulp and scarcity. Yeah. So the pulp mill was this is like really basically the worst possible time for the digester to blow up in that standpoint. But I think anybody would have ever foresaw this mega cycle in pulp.
Yeah.
The other, you know, issue that occurred is when you manufacture your own pulp, you generate a considerable amount of electricity. I mean, quite frankly, the majority of the power that the paper mill was using was coming from the power generated by the pulp mill. Mm-hmm. So when you lost the pulp mill, the mill was then forced to turn to natural gas, you know, which they had to buy from the grid. And Maine is like notoriously known for like a challenging state for natural gas, because it's a really old system of pipelines and it's constrained. And, you know, there's a lot of environmentalists in Maine that, you know, have not allowed further pipelines to be built. And then, you know, like even the, you know, worsening the situation further, the mill happened to sit on the end of the natural gas trunk that also fed an LNG export terminal in Everett, Mass.
Yeah.
So basically what happened is the price that the Androscoggin mill was paying for natural gas wasn't the price wasn't set here really in the U.S. It was basically being set by the marginal price somebody was willing to pay in Europe in the midst of the war they got going there, because you know, they had the choice of, you know, putting it into liquefied natural gas and shipping it to Europe, or sending it to Andro. And, you know, it's just a price decision, unfortunately.
They saw their energy costs go up and become less predictable, I guess.
Yeah. It went from, you know, energy went from a small part of the cost of making paper to a, you know, really considerable portion. And, you know, those things just really, you know, was the death knell for that mill, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, and, you know, it's a bit regrettable because the story goes back much further into the 90s, and whether it's a case of private equity or public owners, but, you know, the stewards of these mills ended up selling a lot of assets off. And if you go back in time, whether it was originally all these mills owned their own forestry land and they sold those off, and then they also owned a lot of their own hydroelectric power, and a lot of all that got, you know, sold off. And you know, which, you know, again, was that, you know, a rational decision at the time? I'm sure it was, but, you know, you eroded the robustness of those businesses by doing that. So I kind of touched on this a little bit before, but I think, you know, if you shift your focus solely from maximizing the rate of return for your investors to creating a more balanced return for all these stakeholders, I think these decisions that we saw at, you know, Anderskogen perhaps would have been different. You know, rebuilding the digester would have, you know, dramatically improved the economics of the mill, and it probably would still be around today. And quite frankly, it probably would be the lowest cost producer of release liners in North America, if not the entire Western Hemisphere.
Wow.
Had they had that digester, they had a really efficient process there. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, they produced a really high quality product that we used, and it'll be a sorely missed liner in our industry, but, you know, I think it was a rational decision what needed to occur
at the time, right?
Yeah, at the time. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the mill at its peak, it employed over 1,000 people. You know, it was the main economic driver of J Main. So without that mill, I mean, you know, you got to think of all the loggers, truckers, people that ran hotels, restaurants, you know, all that secondary employment that, you know, was there serving that mill was really now without work.
Yeah.
You know, so should this be a, you know, a driving factor in the decision to rebuild the digester when the mill closed? I don't know. I mean, if you're Lindsay Goldberg and you own the mill and you had a chance to, you know, you got trapped into, you know, you bought this thing thinking it was a good investment, and, you know, you get in there and you find out that the release liner market at the time was oversupplied, and,
yeah,
you know, you're not making that much money, and, you know, the thing blows up and now you got a chance to get $350 million. I'd probably take the money. I mean, you know, I think it's a tough decision, but I think they're completely rational in it.
Speaking of which, the investments, obviously paper mills require millions of dollars to operate and upkeep. And can you explain why we see such high operating costs in an industry that, you know, gives little return in profits, or, you know, not huge return in profits?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the input cost, you know, as I touched on, you know, particularly pulp and energy have increased, you know, really drastically, nearly doubling. So you have a lot of pressure on your input cost, and then your ability to pass those costs forward to your password to your customers is really constrained. I mean, you're generally speaking, a lot of these markets that are served are oversupplied. You know, going back to like the early 90s, you know, when you had the midst of the internet first coming online, you know, you've had these pressures of constant declining market. At one time, I'm going to get these numbers slightly wrong here, but at one time we had like 25 million tons of paper being produced for newspapers. You know, this year, I think it's going to be around 5 million or less.
Wow.
You know, so it's just like a totally brutal market.
Yeah.
You know, and give you a sense of scale. I mean, you know, the Andro mill, when it closed, was doing around 220,000 tons of paper. So, and that's a big mill.
Yeah.
You know, and they had already shut down multiple machines within that mill. So it's just a really difficult situation. And I think when you have a lot of mills that were designed for markets that were 10 times as big as they are today, and they're shrinking, and everybody goes, oh my God, you know, I got to close the mill, or I need to find a new product. Everybody ends up looking at the same products. you know, in the instance of the market that Smith Corona services on release liners, you know, you had a number of mills that have come into this market and have left because, you know, the market's only, call it 500,000 tons a year of demand. And if you have a big mill like Andrew, that's 140,000 tons comes in, well, that's like 20% of the market. You know, and how do you, if you're the other operator that was already in that space, well, what's going to happen? Well, I mean, it's, you know, the obvious answer is prices have to come down. Mm-hmm. And the highest cost producer likely has to exit, you know, which is just a brutal situation, but it's the reality of what it is. And, you know, in other markets, you know, if you're building, I don't know, semiconductors or something, you know, perhaps you know, the market's still growing. So you have the ability to raise prices, or you have the ability to find a new niche. But in paper, it's just brutal. I mean, there's just nowhere to go.
And, yeah.
You're just constantly stuck to trying to reduce your input cost. And then kind of circling back here a little bit, you know, if you're a rational owner of a mill and you're in a declining market and it's going to cost you $350 million to rebuild your pulp digester, do you really want to put the money into that? Or do you go, hey, I'm going to take this money and I'm going to, you know, invest it in some other industry or something? And I think that that's what we've seen.
That makes sense. Another factor that makes the paper industry financially difficult to maneuver is the customer base. Can you expand on why it's more challenging to satisfy customers in this industry versus others?
Yeah. So, in our industry here, you have Avery Dennison, which I'm just going to use round numbers here, but somewhere around 50% of the demand for these products.
Mm-hmm.
Your next biggest customer is going to be UPM, Raffletech, and that's somewhere around 20-25%. Then you're going to have Green Bay, MacTac, Rico, ourselves, Smith Corona here. And then, you know, between the, you know, 5-6 of us, you're basically at like 95% of the industry.
Yeah.
And I think if you're in that business and that's your customer base where one of your customers is 50%, that's pretty tough. I mean, that's a really big hurdle to overcome. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with the product being frankly somewhat of a commodity as well, you have a situation where, you know, the top two customers can go, you know, you're going to try to raise your price, you know, Mr. Vendor, paper mill, I'm going to go elsewhere. And historically they've been able to do that. And historically they've been able to convince other paper producers, maybe making, you know, coated free sheet or you know, some other grade or something, to come into the release liner market or come into the direct thermal paper market or C1S or whatever it might be. And, you know, it's a really great strategy. I mean, I guess in that sense, if you're a consumer of paper, because there's always somebody else willing to try to make these products. And if you're a paper mill supplying into it, it's just brutal. Again, you know, you got rising input cost, you have nowhere really else to go. And you get into this market thinking, you know, especially papers for PSA is a safe harbor, but then you get in there and you find out, you know, you got, you know, the customers are just brutal.
Yeah.
You know, myself included.
That makes it a tough market. Last time we spoke, we discussed an industry shift to alternative materials like PET for release liners, you know, in response to the paper shortage. But over the last few years, we've seen continuous growth in the paper market for different types of materials, like corrugate and container board. Where's the shift coming from, and why are mills taking the time and money to invest in these specific materials rather than those used to make items like labels?
Yeah. I think today we probably have overinvested in some of those markets like container board and, you know, liner board and that sort of thing. So I think we may see a shift away from that. But again, it goes back to this case of we're chasing, you know, as a paper mill, I have this, you know, fixed asset with a paper mill today, you know, replacement cost on a mill like Andruskoggin would be, well over $1 billion. So you have this asset in the ground, you know, a lot of steel, and you go, I got to find a market where I can go to. Where's one that's growing? Where's one that's, you know, big and healthy? And really one of the few, you know, right places left is corrugated boxes and you know, liner board and those sorts of markets. And, but there's been a lot of investment. There's been a lot of mills that have converted over. And if you look at, you know, like the trade, you know, magazines, you know, we follow here in the paper industry, like RISI, for example, I mean, you can see, you know, millions of tons of capacity coming online here in the next couple of years, all going into corrugated boxes. And you go, where's it all going? I mean, you know, I think to some extent there, you know, there is certainly more demand in the future for, you know, with e-commerce continuing to grow and continuing to take a further share of, you know, away from brick and mortar retail. But it's concerning to me of how much capacity is shifting there. And I think you're going to see a lot of pressure in the next few years on the corrugated box manufacturers. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, with regards to, you know, our industry, you know, last time we spoke, we talked about PET release liners. And at the time, it's kind of interesting. It's only been 4 months or something. And there's been just this dramatic change in our industry where we were all desperate. And when we talked, I was, you know, Chicken Little, sky's falling on me and what's going to happen. And I got to, you know, we got to convince our customers to take this plastic PET liner because there's not going to be enough paper liner.
Mm-hmm.
But with changes in demand, it's, you know, there's more paper than what we know to do with. And we're seeing rolling downtime from a lot of these domestic paper mills manufacturers. And the situation's even worse in Europe. The Trade Association for Labels in Europe called FINOT looked at fourth quarter demand in Europe was down 24% year over year, which is just shocking.
Yeah, that's a big drop.
Yeah, it's really catastrophic. And I think here in North America, our numbers are going to be pretty similar here from what we're seeing. So I think a lot of the need to go to PET liner has kind of, the customers that have changed have already changed. And I don't think we'll see further conversion, quite frankly.
Okay.
But, you know, around, you know, the, where, in terms of where to put my dollars to work, if I'm a paper mill or an investor, I mean, to stand up a PET production facility is, you know, $50 to $100 million to go buy a Bruckner extruder of a building and wall for walls and to do it again, you know, do a paper mill, it's $1 billion and you have, you know, a shrinking market for paper. So I think a lot of these decisions are really just being driven from that framework. Where can I most efficiently deploy this money to get a rate of return?
That makes sense. Well, there are definitely a lot of moving parts in the paper industry, and I want to thank you for helping us to understand it better. And I really enjoyed our discussion today, and I'm thinking maybe in a few months we can revisit this and see where things stand.
Hey, that'd be great. Thank you so much for having me on, Brad. I really appreciate your time, and absolutely, anytime I can be of service, please let me know.
All right. Sounds great.